Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we've heard a lot about the declining number of local newspapers, but there are some bright spots. We'll have a report. Also, a local independent bookstore asks for the public's help to survive. The cicadas are coming. We'll speak with a biologist about why Illinois is a good spot to experience a rare event. We'll also discuss grief among children and a camp that helps them process their feelings. We'll learn more about speech-language pathologists, why their job has gotten harder, which has resulted in some leaving the field. And a central Illinois community settles a lawsuit from a man who spent time in prison for murder and then was exonerated. Those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Over the last two decades, the number of newspapers in the U.S. has dropped by nearly a third. Today, more than 200 counties have no newspaper at all, making them news deserts. Rural areas have been especially impacted. But as Jim Meadows reports, newspapers are experimenting with different strategies in an effort to keep local news alive.
Mount Vernon, Iowa has the quintessential Midwestern downtown, with a cafe, a bank, and a local newspaper. The office of the Mount Vernon Lisbon Sun faces First Street, the word newspaper written in fancy white letters on the front window. Inside the newspaper office, it's another busy day for editor Nathan Countryman.
Finishing up calendar, finishing up the special section. So I've got two stragglers I've got to track down, which is always fun.
The paper serves two small towns in eastern Iowa, surrounded by farmland. Last February, Countryman learned that his paper was being sold. In an unusual move, the University of Iowa student newspaper, The Daily Iowan, a private nonprofit company, bought The Sun and another rural weekly. The new owners are keeping the staff and providing some student reporters to help out, which is good news for Countryman.
It's a lot more breathing room in those regards. It's an ability to have a Monday where I can say, I just need somebody else to cover the city council meeting.
The Daily Iowan's experiment comes as many newspapers are shrinking, merging, or closing. The local news initiative at Northwestern University has data going back to 2005. Director Tim Franklin says the decline has hit hardest in rural areas in the South, Southeast, and Midwest.
You can almost draw a straight line from the Texas-Mexico border, from, say, Brownsville, Texas, up through the spot, what I call the spine of the country. And with some exceptions, almost all the counties are either news deserts or one news outlet counties.
Franklin says declining readership and ad revenue have hurt newspapers everywhere, but it's harder for papers to stay afloat where fewer people live.
In rural areas, the problem is one of scale. Are there enough paying customers in a smaller rural community to be able to support journalism in that area?
In Ford County, Illinois, population 13,500, the weekly Ford County Chronicle is run on a for-profit basis, although no one's getting rich.
It's hard, but every job's hard, right?
That's Will Brumley, the editor, reporter, and co-publisher of the Chronicle, a rare example today of a new newspaper replacing an old one. He and another former employee of a much older local paper started the Chronicle in 2020. Brumlevy says it's a financial risk, but they're devoted to the community.
There's not that many jobs that like make you feel better about the difference you can make in other people's lives and just try to keep people informed of things they need to know. You know, it's important.
Another publisher is trying to fill a news desert in rural West Texas. John Starkey runs a nonprofit media organization in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Last year, he bought the Ozona Stockman in Crockett County, 300 miles away. He plans to expand the paper to cover seven rural counties, some of which have no news outlets at all.
They have spotty internet, they have spotty radio reception, and they have restricted TV because of the geographic parameters of the area. So if they don't have a newspaper, they don't have news. It's that simple.
New business models for newspapers like The Stockman are key as ad revenues slide. That's according to Benji Hamm. He's director of the University of Kentucky's Institute for Rural Journalism and Community Issues. But he doesn't expect things to change overnight.
There will be more newspapers that go out of business. There will be more online sites that determine they can't make a profit. But I think there will continue to be things that emerge to replace that.
And journalists dedicated to local news. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jim Meadows.
Zachary Oren Smith of Iowa Public Radio contributed to that story. The town of Normal has agreed to a $5.4 million payout to settle a wrongful conviction lawsuit. Alan Beeman sued, claiming the town and three now retired police officers framed him in the death investigation of his ex-girlfriend, Jennifer Lockmiller, more than three decades ago. Beeman served nearly 13 years in prison before the Illinois Supreme Court threw out the verdict. John Norton spoke with the court's correspondent, Edith Brady Lunny, who's followed the case for years.
Edith, can you remind us about the premise of this case?
So in 2014, Beeman sued the town of Normal and three retired Normal detectives for malicious prosecution. He alleged that the officers worked with prosecutors to essentially frame him for Lockmiller's murder. One of those prosecutors, Jim Suk, went on to become a McLean County circuit judge. The officers were accused of manipulating timeline evidence to fit their theory that Beeman drove over 70 miles an hour from Rockford to Normal, where he killed Lockmiller within 15 minutes, and then returned home before his mother came home and saw his car in the driveway.
Wow. Were there other suspects in this case, or was he the only one?
Well, one of the other points in the lawsuits relates to the multiple leads and possible suspects that were ignored by the investigators. And once the focus was on Beeman, the investigators worked to build their case against him.
Okay, so this case is headed to trial. April 15th looks like it's the date here in McLean County. Was this a last-minute settlement? Was it a surprise?
Well, settlement negotiations are routine in all civil cases. In Beeman's case, both sides acknowledged the inherent risks, though, of taking the case before a jury and the lengthy appeals that could follow a verdict. The $5.4 million settlement ends the case, and it gives Beeman a guaranteed amount of money for the more than 12 years he served in prison.
Yeah, and I've already read from your reporting that the town of Normal is admitting no wrongdoing with this agreement, and it still stands behind the officers' actions. What does Beeman and his lawyer have to say about this $5.4 million settlement?
Well, the denial of wrongdoing is standard language in settlement agreements. So the legal team for the town was aware that details of Beeman's full exoneration will be part of the evidence and trial, as well as testimony about Beeman's experience in maximum security prisons. The trial was not going to be a retest of Beeman's innocence. It was a determination of who was responsible for sending him to prison. Beeman's lawyers still refer to the conviction of Beeman as a miscarriage of justice. The settlement, they said, is hardly sufficient to compensate him and his family for their suffering brought on by Allen's 13 years of wrongful incarceration. So there's still two very different opinions, but Beeman has been exonerated at every level.
Courts reporter Edith Brady Lunny on the case of Alan Beeman. His murder conviction was overturned by the Illinois Supreme Court in 2008. He's now settled his lawsuit against the town of Normal. By now you've heard this will be a busy year for cicadas. Two broods will emerge at the same time. That's the first time that's happened in a couple hundred years and could make for an exceptionally noisy spring and early summer. Illinois State University biologist Scott Sakaluk is a behavioral ecologist who's done work in entomology, among other areas. He told Charlie Schlinker Illinois is a great place to be to get the best of both broods.
I think they're going to overlap perfectly. It's a small version of cicada geddon, really. We are right in the center of the brood that's coming out to the north of us. And then to the south of us, extending all the way from Georgia, there's another brood, brood 19, that's coming out at the same time.
What are you doing to look at it when it comes?
I am curious about what effect it's going to have on local animals. In particular, I work with a population of birds in the Merwin Preserve at Parklands. And last year we had, and we periodically have problems with raccoon predation. The raccoons get hungry, they climb up into the nest boxes and they grab the young. Well, there's going to be such a bonanza of cicadas that are going to be around. I'm really curious to see whether or not this superabundance of cicadas is going to have an effect on the levels of predation of our birds.
How will you measure that?
Well, it's a very difficult thing to measure because it's not really a planned experiment. It's an uncontrolled experiment. But one thing you can do, and it's no one would consider this uber convincing, but we can look, because we visit these nest boxes twice a week throughout the entire season, and we record predation when it occurs, and we know when it's a raccoon because there's a pattern of the damage that they wreak on the nests in the nest box. So we can look at the frequency of predation on our nests last year, we can look at it this year, and then next year we can see if there's any change in levels of raccoon predation when the cicadas are gone.
Do raccoons enjoy cicadas?
Well, lots of things eat cicadas. Knowing what I know about raccoons, they have very cosmopolitan diets, and they're not going to pass up a superabundance. And let's face it, cicadas are little, not even all that little, they're really nice packets of protein. So there's all kinds of animals, lots of birds, robins, blue jays, starlings gorge themselves, and all kinds of mammals and reptiles.
Is the abundance going to be enough to produce a boom in these other species that prey on cicadas?
I do know, in fact, we just read a paper about this in my lab group, that when they come out, it has, not on every bird species, but lots of insectivorous bird species, it has a discernible effect on the population size in that year, either because it draws birds in to the locality, but it also has an effect on the number of babies that they succeed in producing and their reproductive success that year. So we know these pulses of protein that the cicada emergences represent are having a really marked effect on at least some of the birds and mammals.
How long does that last?
It really is species specific. So there are some species of birds where it seems to be it has an immediate bump, and then you start to see a decrease the following year. In other birds, that effect kind of lingers for a period of several years before the population goes down to baseline. And then there's other species where it doesn't seem to have that much effect at all.
There are media accounts that say trillions and trillions. That may be a little hype. How many cicadas are there in these broods?
Well, so, I mean, I don't know. I don't think trillions and trillions is really necessarily hyperbole. I mean, I was looking at a paper, and again, it varies tremendously, but a paper that reported it in terms of grams of cicadas per unit area, and it gave quite a wide range. But and I don't have the numbers off my head, but I remember thinking that's a remarkable tonnage of cicadas. It's really unbelievable numbers. Trillions? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, my brain doesn't operate in that range of numbers.
How much will people be able to tell the difference? I mean, cicadas happen every year, but these large broods don't happen every 13 or 17 years, depending on their period. What will this be like?
Well, I think the main thing that people are going to notice is two things. One, the density is going to be unusually high. They're going to notice a lot more cicadas. And they're going to notice when the cicadas die, I would expect they're going to notice that there's a lot more, because we always see dead cicadas here every summer, right? Our regular cicadas. But they're going to see a lot more of those. And the other thing that people are going to notice is, you know, the cacophony of sound that we associate with cicadas. It's going to be a lot louder this year, just the sheer numbers, and they're loud insects. Even on an individual level, they're really impressive.
How loud can they be?
I couldn't give you a decibel because to tell you how loud they are, it has to be in reference to the distance that your microphone is from the insect. But they're really loud, and they're really loud because of the way they're built. In their abdomens, they have two rigid discs that are made of chitin. It's only the males that have these because it's only the males that produce sound. And if you lift their wings, you can see these rigid discs that are made of chitin, and they're called timbals. You might remember this as a metaphor for how they produce sound. These little metal insects you used to get at a dime store where you push on them, and they might be in the shape of a metal beetle. You click on them and they click back and they make a sound. And that's exactly how a timbal works. So inside the abdomen of the male, they have these really large muscles that are attached to these chitinous discs. And they pull them in and they buckle out. They pull them in, they buckle out. And they're doing that really rapidly. And most of the interior of the abdomen of a male is hollow. There's nothing else there other than very kind of narrow intestinal tract. That empty abdomen acts as a resonance chamber, and it really amplifies that signal. And they're moving those muscles really rapidly, and they're alternating side to side. And that vibration coupled with the resonance that's created by their abdomen is what's creating that really loud amplitude that we associate with cicadas.
Do their songs vary from brood to brood? Do female cicadas like different things?
The songs vary from species to species. So these broods are not a single species. They're actually an assemblage of species. And each of the species within those broods that are emerging have their own unique acoustic signature. And that difference is usually in the temporal domain, so how they structure their singing in time. And the females of the respective species of the males recognize the stereotypic signal, acoustic signal that's being produced by the male, and they will respond only to that signal. So if I take a female, say, of a 13-year periodical cicada, of a species and play back the song of another species, she won't respond to that.
Illinois State University biologist Scott Sakuluk is a behavioral ecologist, and he spoke with Charlie Schlinker about the emergence of two broods of cicadas this spring. There's more of Statewide on the way. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A recent camp in Springfield was open to kids, but not just any. Staub Funeral Homes offered its Good Grief Camp for those ages 6 through 12. They've been doing it for several years to help young people who have lost someone close. Maureen McKinney interviewed the camp director, Dr. Melissa Franzen, to find out more.
Actually, like 1 in 12 kids are affected by grief by the time they're 18. When you're looking at what developmental level they're at and where they're able to process certain things, 6 tends to be kind of like a tipping point in that scale. Much younger than that, they aren't fully capable of comprehending what comes from the activities that we do. Mm-hmm. Like, they can do them with help, but they wouldn't be associating it and processing it at any particular level that would really be beneficial for them. It's just quite not developmentally there. And then after 12, you tend to get to an age where we're looking at maybe a little bit different approach, because this is more play-based.
Uh-huh.
Because kids' language is play. That's yes. How they talk to us. And so we're doing playful activities with them to engage them to process those deeper inner emotions that aren't really spoken. But once you get to like 13, 14, 15, they're not wanting to play the same. They want to engage, but they do more talk therapy and more deeper level stuff.
What sorts of play activities are there at the camp?
Oh, we start out with a large group activity, and I change that every year on what it is that we do to get them engaged, get them kind of feeling comfortable with the people around them. And then we go into the different rooms, and I have it structured in a kind of past, present, future with the activities, because past being finding ways to talk about the loved one who's passed away, sharing memories about them in a safe environment, and safe meaning emotionally, supported and secure there. And giving them that it's okay to talk about who you miss and who you love. Because often at home, kids won't. Mm-hmm. Because they will see the grief on their caregivers and then not want to add to it. That's one of the main activities, and they're creating either a memory wheel, or we have a box, a memory box, and they decorate it with stickers and shapes and words that represent the person they're missing. We have an activity of what I call it our present activity, and that's learning to work through the emotions we're having right now and how to express them appropriately, particularly anger, because that's one that really sneaks up on us. And especially on the kiddos, and how it's okay to be angry, but how do we express it? Then how do we work through it?
How long has STOB been doing the camp? Is it specific to them, and is it unusual, or are there camps like this?
I believe STOB family has been sponsoring this camp for about 10 years. It was my understanding it was actually something of their creation. Working with families day in and day out, you know, taking care of the loved ones who have passed, there's a lot of time spent with the adults in the room, mm-hmm. making decisions, giving them information to read, giving them support services, you know, resources in the community. But often the kids are kind of, they saw that they were just kind of there along the way, and they wanted to do something that would help the kids also. And so they created this idea, and it has grown to what it is today. I am not aware of another program like this, at least not anywhere around here.
Do kids experience grief differently than adults? And if so, how so?
The heaviness, the weight of losing someone you care about is there for everyone. The difference is, as adults, we're able to express it. And we may not always choose the most healthy coping strategies, but we can talk about it. We can, like, rationalize it and walk through it for ourselves. Children don't necessarily have those skills because a lot of them, it's the first time they've experienced the loss of a loved one. So they have all those feelings, but they don't know what to do with it or how to process it. And as I mentioned earlier, they kind of hide it from their loved ones because they don't want to be a burden or make them more sad. And so they internalize it, and then it ends up coming out in various behaviors. You'll see anger outbursts for some, lack of attention and focus. You'll see some similar to adults when they're grieving, like extreme tiredness, like lethargy, not wanting to engage in activities that they normally do. All of these will come out, but they typically struggle to be able to tell you why it's happening. So even if a parent checks on them, they can assume what's going on, but unlike adults, the children typically don't have the words.
Is this hard for the counselors?
It definitely is kind of a heavy weight on your heart. You hold a lot of space for these children. It's a joyful moment because you get to watch some of them walk into the camp completely secluded and quiet, like not wanting to participate. And by the end of the day, some of them are running around and asking questions of the other kids and like willingly sharing their story. And it is a beautiful thing to watch. But I also hold space for the heaviness for our volunteers and our therapists and counselors. And so actually at the end of the day, we have a time, and it's probably one of the heavier moments of the day. The caregivers or adults responsible for the children are able to come back, and we have a slideshow of what they did that day. And so they get to see what their kiddos are doing. And then we have a moment where the children read something that they wrote earlier in the day to their missing loved one. And then we go plant those messages with a tree out at the park. And it's a very symbolic moment. And then that tree is there for them to come visit every year. You know, it's always there. They can come back whenever they want. And it's so at the end of the day, after we do all of that, I typically take the counselors out and we process and we talk about how the day went, how they're feeling, where they're at with it. And then talk about like some of the different children. I often try to do like a follow-up, like, was there anyone that you particularly noticed that struggled a little bit more or may need more resources, just to make sure we get them connected with some services?
What resources are in the bags?
There is a storybook that talks about basically how to talk about grief with kiddos and like kind of normalizing the experience. We have a couple other activities for them to do. I give them my business card so they can always reach out to me. And if they need more, then I have a list of like community resources or counselors in the area that they can.
What sort of play activities are there?
They talk about their anger and they do drawings of like what their anger looks like. And then we actually post it up for them. And it sounds really weird, but you take cotton balls and you get them wet. And then you take them and you just throw them at your picture, at whatever your anger is, whatever is going on. And it's that physical movement for them really helps release some of the tension. But it also makes this amazing splat sound and the kids love it. It is so fun to watch them do that. We also do a craft activity where they are building. We have another activity that might be the favorite activity for the kids next to the therapy dogs. And that is our future activity. And we're trying to help them identify when hard things happen in our life and it kind of feels like the world just kind of crumbles, that we're able to kind of rebuild that and move forward. It doesn't look exactly the same, but it's still beautiful and there's still, you know, purpose and a path. And so to do that, they actually get to break like clay flower pots or the plate that the flower pots sit on. They use like a mallet and get to break it. And then the therapist and the volunteers help them rebuild it like with hot glue and they decorate it to make it beautiful. And a lot of times they'll put like the name of the person they're missing on there. And we show them how they can still put it back together and still use it and move forward. And it's just, it's great to watch.
What are some of the situations that occur causing young people to experience grief? A grandparent, parent, another child?
For this particular camp, we are talking about the loss of a loved one. It could be a sibling. We have parents who do unfortunately face like the loss of a pregnancy and a miscarriage. And from that, or even the sibling being alive, like it's strongly affecting these children regardless, because that is their sibling. And between that and the others you mentioned, we have children who are kind of across that spectrum of who they've lost. And the camp helps for each of them. And we have campers who come back each year. And they'll come back multiple times because working with these children at each age, you're at a different developmental level. And so you understand things differently. And so doing the activities, they're processing them differently every time they do them. And they're gaining more knowledge about themselves and how to work through this.
What advice would you have for a parent whose child who's lost someone close?
Be aware that your children are going to have reactions to this, even if they're not what you expect to see. You're going to see behavior changes. You might see, you know, a change in sleep pattern. You might even see a regression in behaviors or age-appropriate behaviors. So a child who was fairly independent and tying their shoes and brushing their teeth and doing those things, they may be asking for help getting dressed. They may want you to, you know, tie their shoes. They may wait for you to tell them to do these things that they used to know. But it's how they're kind of processing and they're seeking like that connection back with you, kind of like a security of you're still here. So giving yourself and your child some grace and remembering that it's okay if it happens, and just give them some time and work through it with them. But then also seek support, seek counseling for yourself, for the children. There are so many great licensed counselors in this area that can work with you and your children to work through these different situations. I think sometimes we think, oh, everyone deals with grief. I just have to deal with it. And the truth is, there's support for you. And it's okay to get support. Don't be afraid of letting your child go through, you know, like a camp like this. Don't let that fear stop you from processing it and letting them process it too.
Dr. Melissa Franzen speaking with Maureen McKinney about a recent grief camp for kids. It's held every year in Springfield. Speech therapists, also known as speech-language pathologists, or SLPs for short, are facing major challenges like stagnant pay and sky-high caseloads. It's making many consider leaving the field. Peter Medlin has more on the problems and how it hurts their patients.
Inside a barn in rural Kane County, a little girl helps take the bridle off a horse while talking to her speech therapist, Elizabeth Nielsen. She set up activities around the barn alongside the horses and goats.
A lot of like advocacy stuff with her right now, and just overall being able to like express her needs and how her body feels and what feels good, what doesn't feel good.
This is Nielsen's private speech therapy clinic, Tiny Voice. Against the cozy farm backdrop, they treat kids with communication disorders, including autism, feeding disorders, and others that fall under the umbrella of speech-language pathology. Nielsen loves her work and sees how crucial it is, but
we're just tired. We're not being valued, I feel like.
For one, she says insurance reimbursement rates, including Medicaid, are, as she puts it, insultingly low.
I haven't seen a rate increase in insurance in years. And they actually decreased the rates for a while. And when they increased, it was only like a few cents more than what it was at.
She's an early intervention service provider, but can't take on many of those clients because reimbursements are so low. And she says insurance companies deny communication devices for kids who need them, and some plans don't cover developmental speech and language disorders. Nielsen works primarily with kids at her private practice, but speech-language pathologist is a broad term. There are SLPs who work in schools helping kids with speech delays, in hospitals with patients with swallowing problems, at home settings assisting elderly patients with memory issues, and much more. Not many people know exactly what speech therapists do and why it's important. That's one of the reasons Audrey Myers thinks they're undervalued. She's a speech therapist who works in at-home settings with elderly patients in Northern Illinois.
A lot of our jobs are like life and death. If they choke and aspirate on something, get pneumonia and pass, I could have saved that.
She feels like she has to compete with physical and occupational therapy to prove to insurance companies why her work is just as important.
Communication is key. Cognition is key. They can't do PT and OT without communicating.
Myers has been an SLP for over a decade and says her pay has barely budged. With inflation, it's a pay cut. And it's especially tough considering the level of education and licensing requirements you need to be a speech therapist. You need a master's degree to pass a national licensing test and continue professional development. She took this at-home job after a rough experience working in nursing homes. Caseloads soared, so 45-minute sessions became 15-minute whirlwinds where she had to help lift patients out of bed and was barely doing any real therapy.
It broke my soul to work there, to be honest.
Stress is a universal concern for speech-language pathologists. In a recent survey, 76% of respondents cited above-average stress levels as a significant weakness of the profession, and 83% noted salary as a weakness. The at-home gig offers more flexibility and more time with her patients, but now she's battling with insurance companies to get enough referrals, and she's not sure if this work is sustainable either.
I feel like I'm doing it just because I'm stuck? I don't know. It's such a sad feeling.
Conditions like this are forcing many speech therapists to leave the field. People like Bethany Rasmussen. She spent a decade as an SLP in hospitals, and when she started, she was at a 350-bed facility with only one speech therapist.
It was insane. I mean, it was evaluations all day, absolutely no treatment.
She reached her breaking point 2 years ago after another Christmas away from her family due to staffing issues.
I wish I would have done it a lot sooner, but it makes me sad because what I was doing before was actually directly impacting people and their ability to speak and swallow. But it made my life so much harder that I doubt I'll ever go back.
Many of the challenges are the same as when she entered the field over 10 years ago. But like pay rates, things just haven't improved in that time. Rasmussen thinks about students who want to become speech therapists today, whether in hospitals, schools, or private practices.
I would tell them to run very fast to something else.
There is a national organization who advocates for better working conditions for speech-language pathologists. It's called the American Speech-Language Hearing Association, or ASHA. But many speech therapists say, even though ASHA says they're doing everything they can to help improve reimbursement and productivity rates, they're just not seeing it. I'm Peter Medlin.
We'll continue with more of Peter's reporting in just a moment, here on Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Speech therapists, also known as speech-language pathologists, or SLPs for short, are facing major challenges, and it's making many consider leaving the field. Peter Medlin continues his reporting on why speech therapists are so frustrated with their national advocacy group.
Elizabeth Nielsen is working with a young client at her private speech therapy clinic in rural Kane County. Her clinic, Tiny Voice, is on a small farm complete with pigs, goats, and horses. And Nielsen weaves the animals into her speech-language lessons, and the warm barnyard makes for a uniquely comforting space for kids with communication disorders.
We have a couple of like communication boards, so for my kids that are non-speaking, use communication devices. I do have a pillow that we put on the horse that they can rest their communication device on the horse so that they can use their device.
Nielsen often works with 8 clients a day, and after 8 hours of direct therapy with her kids, then there's lesson planning, report writing, insurance billing, invoices, and oh yeah, the farm work too. And for all that work, the insurance reimbursement they get, including Medicaid, are, as she puts it, insultingly low.
I haven't seen a rate increase in insurance in years. And they actually decreased the rates for a while. And when they increased, it was only like a few cents more than what it was at.
Many speech-language pathologists, whether private practice, in schools, hospitals, or at-home settings, also say they face soaring caseloads and productivity rates. Audrey Myers is another speech therapist in Northern Illinois. She works in at-home settings with elderly patients, and she says SLPs are fighting other battles too, with referrals, insurance authorizations, and approvals.
Insurance is really strict on the number of times we can go, especially for speech therapy. You know, I'll get a new patient and it says one visit allowed. I can do an evaluation, sure, but they're probably going to need therapy if they wanted me to come in there in the first place.
There is a national organization who advocates for better working conditions for speech-language pathologists. It's called the American Speech-Language Hearing Association, or ASHA. But many speech therapists, like Nielsen, say even though ASHA says they're doing everything they can to help improve reimbursement and productivity rates, they're not seeing it.
We're passionate about helping these people, but we're taking advantage of it.
Nielsen says ASHA has a certification product called the Certificate of Clinical Competence, or the CCCs, that costs over $200 per year. And many, including Bethany Rasmussen, say they don't know what they're actually paying for aside from getting to put 3 C's next to their signature. Rasmussen spent a decade as an SLP in hospitals in Northern Illinois before quitting 2 years ago because of the working conditions. And even though she left the field, she's still paying for the certification because she thought she would need it if she ever decided to go back.
In Illinois, I now know you don't actually need it to practice. But I didn't even know that. It's sad that there's so much misinformation that they certainly are not going to be the ones to clear things up for us since it wouldn't financially benefit them.
ASHA says the certification ensures a standard of quality. To get it, therapists have to complete professional development hours and abide by a code of ethics. But Illinois licensure already requires the same number of professional development hours and mandates ethics training. Nielsen says she has to pay for it in order to supervise grad students, but other speech therapy advocacy groups say that's not true either, and if universities say it's required, it's based on old information. Therapists are afraid that if they don't renew, they'll have to retake their license exams or even go back to school, and some employers require it even though it's not part of the state licensure process.
There's still this like fear of like, I need to have my C's, I need to have this product.
Therapists like Nielsen say that too much of ASHA's money goes to lobbying to have their product linked with state licensure or Medicaid reimbursement. In a statement to WNIJ, an ASHA spokesperson said they don't lobby to make the CCCs required, just to offer it as a pathway to licensure. But in 2022, they wrote in support of regulations in Nevada that would require speech therapists to pay for their product to renew their standard license. And they lobby to make sure grad students are supervised by people who hold their certification. And the group does advocate for important issues speech therapists call for, like Medicare funding. Back at the farm, Elizabeth Nielsen is using one of her horses, named Eli, for an activity with one of her clients. The main goal of the game is to feel comfortable verbalizing your needs. She says so much of what she does is about teaching people how they can advocate for themselves. And Illinois-based therapists like Nielsen say they wish they had someone advocating for them. She wants the organization to spend more time focusing on issues they're facing on the ground, ones that are making many speech therapists wonder if they have a future in their profession. I'm Peter Medlin.
The number of Black students enrolled in college in Illinois has dropped by over a third in the past decade, and a big deterrent is cost. Need-based scholarships are one way to make sure more of these students can sign up and finish school, but that type of financial aid is becoming less of a priority for many schools. Instead, they've targeted money towards students with high GPAs and test scores. Lisa Corian Phillip reports.
Layla Granville looks kind of winded. She took two buses, the Green Line, then walked 13 minutes to get to class today. She lives on the South Side and is a freshman at Dominican University in the western suburbs. It was a journey she had to get used to.
At first, my legs were like hurting. I didn't walk that much in like a minute.
But she's come to like the two-hour commute. She uses the train ride to read fantasy novels. They're her favorite.
I love strong female characters. Like the one I'm reading now, it's like a female assassin and she's young and she's like the best one. I'm like, you're amazing.
So is Layla. She's majoring in biochemistry with a minor in physics, which is crazy considering college was almost not in the cards for her. It really came down to one factor.
I know my family couldn't help pay for it.
Research from Gallup shows Black students like Layla often cite money as the biggest hurdle standing between them and a college degree. The Federal Reserve reports their families, on average, hold a small fraction of the wealth that white families do. Black students are more likely to have to borrow to cover tuition and to juggle full-time jobs with class.
I didn't know how I was going to pay for college, even though I wanted to go.
Fortunately for Layla, Dominican offered a lifeline, a scholarship program for students from low-income families interested in science that didn't require a high GPA. It's made it possible for Layla to go to college without taking on a bunch of debt or a job to pay her tuition. Instead, she can just focus on school.
Seeing how stressed I am about like some of the classes and like the workload, I couldn't imagine working on top of it. I don't think I would have lasted.
Many young people from low-income families don't get scholarships. Over the past two decades, colleges have shifted more and more money away from need-based scholarships to so-called merit aid for students with high GPAs and test scores. That's according to research from the think tank New America. That means instead of prioritizing full rides for low-income students like Layla, colleges are handing out what are basically tuition discounts to compete for high-achieving students who have lots of college options. Marie Bigham is with the equity nonprofit Accept Group.
The students with the higher GPAs and the higher test scores are going to come from better funded schools. They're going to have more opportunities. Chances are likely that they have more in family wealth.
College leaders defend the strategy. They say even with the merit aid, wealthy students pay more tuition and subsidize spots for students like Layla, who can't afford to pay any tuition at all. But researchers say the increased spending on merit aid has mainly benefited white, wealthy students, and it's actually reduced the number of low-income and Black students on campus. Akil Bello with the advocacy group Fair Test says the issue is not that Black and low-income students are not capable of getting good grades. It's that they're more likely to attend a high school with fewer supports and have other obligations competing for their time.
Guess what? Poor kids who have to take a part-time job are going to have a lower GPA.
Take Layla. When she was in high school, she worked at a Chili's restaurant on the weekends. She says her GPA was low and put her out of the running for most scholarships. And for Layla, getting a scholarship meant the difference not in where she went to college, but whether or not she could go at all.
I don't even have to like look at my financial aid thing. I'm like, I'm glad I don't have to worry about it.
Instead, she can focus on nerding out on her math and science classes. In her biology lab, she's been running genetic experiments.
I kind of felt bad because you had to, like, knock out the fruit flies.
Really?
Yeah, to like separate their like eye color. You
can actually Lisa Corian Phillip, WBEZ News.
The bookselling industry has had its ups and downs, and for small independent bookstores up against giant online retailers and big box stores, those downs can really hurt. Jane Carlson tells us about a Galesburg bookstore asking for the public's help.
Bookstores selling new books are few and far between in rural areas, and locally owned shops selling both children and adult titles as well as magazines are even more rare. But you can find all of that when you walk into Wordsmith Bookshop on Main Street in Galesburg.
Between I-80 and I-72, which is the Quad Cities down to Quincy, and from the Mississippi River to the Illinois River, we are basically the only full-service new bookstore.
Owner Terry Parks grew up in Galesburg and remembers the bookstores of Galesburg past, like the Walden Books at the now-shuttered Sandburg Mall. Before that, there was Dave's Books downtown. As a teenager working at the public library, Parks would run across the street and thumb through Dave's inventory. For Parks, the love of books and bookstores started early, but working in the industry came later in life. So in 2018, when Book World, Inc. closed all 45 of its bookstores in the Midwest, including the one at the West Burlington Mall, where Parks was the manager, she wasn't quite done with book selling.
It took me 30 years to find my dream job. And once I found that, then I was totally heartbroken when I learned that Book World was going to close.
At that time, Galesburg Stone Alley Books had recently closed its doors. And Brighter Life, a Christian bookstore, changed its business model to focus more on gifts. It was Park's husband who started looking into opening a bookstore in Galesburg. He went to banks and started figuring out the logistics.
And he came home and he says, "Do you want to open a bookstore?" And I said, "No." Because I didn't feel confident enough in the industry. You know, I mean, being a manager is a lot different than being an owner. So I thought about it for 3 days, couldn't sleep, was making a whole bunch of notes, and finally said, "Okay, let's do this."
The couple worked hard for about a year to get Wordsmith Bookshop off the ground. They opened in August of 2019. After the first holiday season, Parks was regrouping and trying to figure out what the shop would focus on. And then the global pandemic hit.
And in all honesty, that was a blessing in disguise for us, only because it allowed us to really step back and say, okay, we need to focus on our website, we need to focus on this, we need to focus on this. We kind of became a necessity to the community because they were looking for things to do. You had kids who were not in school who needed books.
4 years after the start of the pandemic, things are trending in a different direction for Wordsmith Bookshop. Parks calls it riding the wave. In a letter to the community posted on the store's Facebook page, she says the store's place in the community has changed as the economy has changed.
We're now more of a luxury item instead of a necessity. So that has thrown us over the wave and on the downside of that wave for right now.
In fact, Park says Wordsmith Bookshop is almost at the bottom of that wave. While their expenses are up, just like everyone else's, sales have been down dramatically since August. Sales have been down dramatically since August. And the holiday season, which helps many retailers power through the slower winter months, didn't have the oomph they needed.
And we expect that. We don't expect things to let us ride high on those waves forever. Knowing that we can recognize that early and take action against it, you know, and that's what our plea was out to the community.
That plea is to buy local. Wordsmith needs to sell around 1,700 books a month to maintain its current hours and staffing. Last month, they sold around 1,000. And Park says, even if people cannot afford to shop, they can spread the word.
Amazingly, we still have people every week, probably 40 to 50 people a week, who walk in the door and say, "I didn't even know you were here."
Parks tears up when she talks about the community response to her plea. That Facebook post asking for support has been shared around 800 times.
And then we've had other small businesses in the community who are pillars in our community help us get the word out. And then they have also stopped in and given us just verbal and moral support.
Wordsmith Bookshop regularly hosts local author events and carries puzzles, toys, and book-related gifts made by area artisans. The store also can special order books that aren't already on the shelves. I'm Jane Carlson.
That will do it for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for being along and join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find all of our episodes, including this one, at this station's website and where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.